Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. One of the threats to our country that we've not been paying as much attention to of late as we should and as we have in the past, at least the recent past, is that emanating from what I think of as Sharia supremacists. That's to say, people who embrace a foundational doctrine of Islam and abide by its injunction that to be faithful Muslims, they must engage in jihad. A man who has studied these topics and much more about Islam, its history, the violence that it has unleashed on the world for, 14 centuries or so, and where we find ourselves vis-a-vis organizations that exhibit this jihadist proclivity, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's Palestinian Islamic Jihad, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's, the Muslim Brotherhood. It all comes down to the same basic proposition, a quest for dominance worldwide, a new caliphate. And to talk about all of these subjects, I couldn't be more pleased to have with us one of the most impressive scholars of these subjects I have encountered, certainly in the West. A man who, his family has hailed from Egypt, where as Coptic Christians, they experienced firsthand the kind of, supremacism of which I'm speaking. He has grown up in this country, is a very important contributor to the public policy debate about what we should do, as well as understand, about Islamism, as some have called it, and the threat that it poses. His name is Raymond Ibrahim. He is the author of four important books, beginning with The Al-Qaeda Reader. In addition, Crucified Again, which talks about the Islamists' new war on Christianity. And two books that are very much steeped in the history of all of this. One is Sword and Scimitar, about 14 centuries of conflict between Islam and Christianity. And the brand new book, I'm very pleased to say, Defenders of the West, the Christian heroes who stood against Islam. Raymond is a highly regarded individual with credentials as a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, as a Senior Fellow of the Middle East Forum, and as a Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Gatestone Institute. And we're very proud to call him a friend as well as a colleague and welcome him to a full hour of conversation about all of these topics. Raymond Ibrahim, we're delighted to have you here at Securing America. Welcome, sir.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for having me. Very happy to be with you.
Well, as am I with you. Let me ask you to sort of level set. I've thrown a number of terms out that I'd like to just, calibrate for our audience with you. Sharia, the wellspring of Sharia supremacism, how would you describe it and its importance? Not necessarily to all Muslims, but certainly to those who regard themselves as most faithful, the most adherent, the most, true believers, shall we say.
Yes, the word Sharia, excuse me, etymologically, it's an, of course, Arabic word. And interestingly, like many Arabic words, especially those that are found in the Quran and Islam-related words, because they go straight back to the 7th century, actually is related to, of course, the Bedouin mentality and Bedouin lifestyle. And it means the road or the route to water, or in this context, to life. And so, the word itself captures the idea that this is the correct path to what is essential, of course, water, life, especially in a barren desert landscape. Of course, it's now means, including in Islam, means what we loosely translate as Islamic law. Okay. And Islamic law or Sharia, it's really very methodical, and in a way that's a good thing because it helps you ascertain what is in fact part of Islam, part of the road to life, and what is not. And we probably don't have enough time to get into the actual all the meticulous aspects, but the long and short of it is the pillars of Islamic law are the Quran, which is understood to be the revealed word of God or Allah, revealed to his prophet Muhammad. And the word Quran, of course, means to recite. So Muhammad was ordered to recite all these words, which later were written down in the book. And of course, there's the Hadith. And the Hadith is just massive compilations, volumes and volumes from different compilers throughout the early centuries of Islam, which purport to contain the words, deeds, thoughts, observations, commandments, actions of Muhammad. And based on that, and again, they have a whole complex way of trying to determine which one is accurate and which is not. But basically, there's probably seven which are loosely seen as canonical, two especially, Sahih Muslim, Sahih means authenticated, and Sahih Bukhari especially. So anything in those, in the Quran or in those volumes, is that, you had people like
Ibn Hamdul,
sacred texts, basically, yeah. And but much more than, let's say, the Bible, there are just so many different commandments. You had Ibn Hanbal refused to eat a watermelon because he couldn't find Muhammad, an instance of Muhammad eating a watermelon. So he decided that's haram, forbidden. So based on those texts, and there's other aspects, consensus or ijma, which means what the ulama, the scholars, what they all agree to. Also analogy, trying to find an analogy. So for example, nothing in Islamic scripture says you can't smoke, because obviously they didn't have that back in the time. But if you can't drink, let's say, wine because it's harmful for you, then through analogy, they'll say you shouldn't smoke either, and so forth.
And that brings me to a key aspect of Sharia. There's an awful lot of religious restrictions or injunctions,
right,
about dietary practices and what you wash and, when, and, the kinds of how you conduct yourself in your personal life. But there's also this element that is very much, I guess, what has come to be called political Islam as well. And is it fair to describe that as basically supremacist in character, that Islam must, by Allah's direction, dominate all others, most especially, I guess, people of other faiths?
Right. Yeah. So, as you say, Sharia encompasses everything. In fact, everything in the Muslim's life, there's five categories, which is basically obligatory, permissible, neutral, you can do it or not do it, discouraged, you shouldn't do it, but it's not a sin, and of course, forbidden. For our purposes, we're not going to discuss, dietary habits, but for our purposes, I think what's important is what is the Islamic Sharia view of the non-Muslim and how all that works, the relationships, including international and otherwise. And in short, of course, it's supremacist. And that's because its foundations are very tribal. This is founded in the 7th century. In many ways, I've described Islam as basically tribalism deified, because Muhammad basically took the tribal mores of his 7th century society, which were very evident, and it codified itself and became part of the theology. And yeah.
Evident, and I think it's fair to say rather primitive as well.
Primitive, of course.
And, we're going to get into how that translated into conduct right after a short break. Raymond Ibrahim is with us. We're going to talk more about Islam, Sharia, and jihad right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The son of the last Shah of Iran, Prince Reza Pahlavi, spoke powerfully yesterday to and for the Iranian people. His speech was widely broadcast and well received. It can help bring down the tyrannical regime that's long misruled them and threatens us. The prince says he's not interested in running a successor government, but he outlined what it should look like, namely one that is democratic and therefore accountable, secular, instead of theocratic, and inclusive, truly representing his nation's many ethnic minorities, religions, and regions. Barack Obama says it was a mistake when he ignored such aspirations in 2009 in pursuit of a nuclear deal with the Ayatollahs. The Biden administration is signaling its efforts to do the same are at an end. We must now demonstrate our solidarity with those seeking freedom in Iran and actually help them achieve it. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Raymond Ibrahim, a distinguished scholar of Islam, a highly acclaimed author, and a fellow of several organizations that I regard very highly, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the Middle East Forum, and the Gatestone Institute specifically. Raymond, I want to just take what you've said about Sharia and put this in the context of the direction that Sharia provides to the faithful Muslim to engage in efforts to achieve the triumph of their faith over all others, and indeed as the ruling power of the world, a caliphate, if you would, guided by this path, Sharia. Talk us through that and some of the insights that you've drawn from your historical analysis of what's happened in the past 14 centuries in this regard.
Sure, Frank. I would say to distill it down to the three most problematic aspects of the Sharia worldview vis-a-vis the non-Muslim is that, first, the Muslim is actually obligated to hate the non-Muslim. Okay, and here we go back to the tribalistic slash primitive mentality. And this is actually captured all over in the Quran. Quran 64, it has a verse about, it portrays my namesake, Ibrahim, of course, which would be the Abraham, the patriarch, as saying to his people, I hate you until you come to believe in my God, and nothing will exist between us except enmity and warfare. And I can go into other verses in the Quran. It says, by name, do not take the Christians and the Jews for friends. They are their own friends. If you take them for friends, you're an infidel like them. And we can, you know, there's so much more we can get into. But so definitely there's enmity involved. This enmity manifests itself in calls to jihad, which is, of course, armed struggle, warfare to spread Islam to the rest of the world. That's actually the mission, including in the Muslim Brotherhood, which tries to present itself as nonviolent and so forth, because it's actually integral to the Islamic worldview. And the final aspect is the culmination of this is the infidel is either, he has three choices. He either submits to Islam, becomes a Muslim, Islam wins that way, or he keeps his religion, especially if he's what's called the person of the book, Jews, Christians, and so forth. But he lives as a second-class citizen and pays tribute. And really, and this, we can see elements of this and, you know, continue all throughout the Islamic world where minorities live. Or he dies and he gets killed. And so that's the doctrinal.
Am I correct in understanding that if you're not a Christian or Jew, people of the book, you actually only have two choices?
Right.
One is convert or perish.
Right. Yeah. That's the theoretic choice. But in certain instances, for example, in the massive jihad in India, where millions were butchered, it got so old butchering them that they eventually started giving this third option of living as a second class citizen to even people who are non-scriptuaries or non people of book, because it became too impractical.
Just too many to kill.
It was better to just basically enslave them and make them pay tribute. Yeah.
Yeah. Which brings me to another aspect of all of this, of course. And again, let me just stipulate that there are an awful lot of Muslims. I think, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims in America, for starters, who don't want any part of all of this. In fact, I think we can argue that many of them came here to get away from Sharia in their native lands. And yet, there is still this attitude, this doctrine, this teaching within the authorities of Islam on the one hand, and those who are prominent in the Islamic community's infrastructure, for want of a better term, in this country. You mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, that they believe this is the path, this is the only way, and that how do they regard Muslims who do not embrace and live in accordance with Sharia, Raymond?
Well, as you say, there's, you know, a vast continuum of Muslims, from those who the ideas that I've just basically delineated, who they embrace it wholeheartedly and try to implement it, to those who, you know, living in the West, we can just characterize them as your average Western person who, of whatever faith they may have, it's internalized and it's not expressed outwardly. So you definitely have that. I think it's important to continue in building this context, though, to say that historically, because, you know, I've given you the doctrines and, you know, the hostility and the jihad and so forth, but that's not just, you know, old musty texts. This actually manifested itself century after century after century, you know, to the point that we forget that in the 7th century when Islam was born and the jihad basically begins in earnest a few years after the death of Muhammad, traditional date 632. In one century, from 632 to 732, that's the Battle of Tours, of course, Islam had swept through, conquered all of North Africa, the Middle East, Spain, and was in, of course, France, and much later, different iterations of Islam, the Turks, the Ottomans, the Seljuks, all the way up into Vienna and the Balkans. What's interesting about that is historians will talk about these, and they'll admit to them, of course, because it's just history, but they won't give you the ideological pinnings. But if you dig through the text, and what I find interesting is what ISIS says, basically what I just discussed, you know, jihad and hate for the infidel. That's actually what all of these sultans and caliphs and emirs and, you know, jihadist warlords, that's exactly how they rationalized their war all the way up until America's first war as a nation, the Barbary Wars. And as you probably know, when Jefferson met with the ambassador saying, why are you pillaging our ships, American ships, enslaving American sailors, mocking them, you know, treating them horribly, the ambassador said, it's in our book, in our Quran, and our holy prophet says you're our enemies and we have to do this and that. So I think it's important to underscore that historically that has been the mainline interpretation of Islam. Now you fast forward to today, Muslims living in the West and so forth. I certainly agree with you. There are those who, you know, would prioritize more the secular worldview because they benefit from it than the traditional worldview. But the traditional worldview is alive and well. In the Islamic world, in the West as well, because we have problematic teachings and doctrines within Islam that actually encourage Muslims to conceal how they feel towards the infidel. So even in the Quran, where it calls on Muslims to hate the non-Muslim, it'll say unless you're doing something via precaution, and that's where we get the word taqiyya in that verse. The Arabic word it comes from the root taqi, which means to fear. So if you fear for your life or you fear you might be exposed because you're under non-Muslim control or authority, then you're encouraged to smile in their face. You can renounce Muhammad. You can say, I'm not even a Muslim. There were in Spain during the Reconquista, because Muslims had conquered Spain in the 8th century, and many centuries later, they were finally evicted in the 15th and 16th century. But towards the end, you had a large Muslim population that didn't want to leave. And so they were all encouraged to pretend to become Christians and renounce their Islam. And they did it for generations. Okay, so father to son to grandson were all Christians, baptized, went to church regularly. And in their hearts, they were still fanatical Muslims who preached hate for the Christians and were trying to subvert Islam. And in Sword and Scimitar, you have one Spaniard. Yeah, exactly. You had one Spaniard who's like, they were better Christians than we were. And yet in their heart, they were still doing this. So again, and having said that, I'm not trying to say there are no moderate Muslims. It's just, it gets very convoluted.
No, I understand. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, their aspiration for both revenge and a return to the previous order is also a tenet of Islam, that if they ever controlled a territory or occupied it, it's theirs in perpetuity.
And that's one of the... And
just
that's
a quick question. Yeah. We have to take another break here, and I want to come back to this point about, to the extent that there are, in fact, authentically moderate Muslims, and I believe there are, the people who don't want to live under Sharia, as I say, who don't want to have to practice it, don't want to impose it on anybody else. I want to get your thoughts, Raymond Ibrahim, on how they are regarded by those faithful Sharia-adherent Muslims. And we'll talk about that and much more with Raymond Ibrahim on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We are speaking with one of our country's most, I think, thoughtful, accomplished, and accurate analysts of the phenomenon of Islam in practice, especially how it has translated into, jihadist warfare against others, Christians notably, but Hindus and Buddhists and many others besides, over 14 centuries. Raymond is the author of several really important books, including his first, The Al-Qaeda Reader, something he found in the bowels of the Library of Congress when he was employed there and brought to light after 9/11 very helpfully. His most recent book is entitled Defenders of the West, The Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. It's brand new. You can get it at wherever books are sold and on Amazon, of course. And congratulations on that newest masterwork, Raymond Ibrahim. So to go back to something we touched on before, Raymond, as we're trying to figure out the magnitude of this problem of Islam, and the calling upon faithful Muslims in accordance with Sharia to engage in the jihad that you've chronicled has been the hallmark of this faith for literally 14 centuries. How do they regard those Muslims in this country and elsewhere who profess that, you know, they're not interested in observing the requirements of Sharia? They consider themselves to be Muslims, faithful Muslims at that, but they don't want any part of what Sharia does, you know, to not only people of other faiths or commands to be done to them, but for that matter, women within their own society and the like. Are they regarded as, you know, just people who have a different view of Islam or in a rather different light by the Sharia adherent?
Yeah, that's a great question. And really, the only way we can answer is by looking at different nations and you know, how this question is responded to in the Muslim world vis-a-vis, for example, the West. It's different. Surprisingly, you know, even the radical, strict Islamist, you know, types, authoritarian types, are give a lot of leeway for un-Islamic behavior as long as it doesn't jeopardize the Islamic order. So for what I mean by that, it's not so much that the types that we're talking about, you know, the Islamist types, that they care if other Muslims, for example, let's say drink alcohol or if they, you know, fornicate out of marriage, even though they have, you know, four wives and so forth. As long as they are whatever they're doing is ultimately helping the Islamic order. So, for example, in the West, I don't think in Iran or in Saudi Arabia they mind that there are moderate Muslims in the West, because if anything that just makes them look better, it takes the lens off of Islam, and so in that sense actually helps them. And you see that a lot. Now, where the moderates and these types become a problem is in the Muslim world, where they actually are seen as dissidents, because if they get enough influence and more Muslims become moderate or secularized or so forth, then, of course, that is a problem. And a lot of these, purported reformers, we know some, of course, in the West who speak English, and I'm sorry to say they don't have much influence except on Americans and Europeans in general, because we understand our language, literally. But if you really want to talk about the real reformers in the Muslim world and the Arab world, they're there. And most of them we don't know about, but a lot of them get in immense trouble. They get killed, they get arrested, they get thrown in jail.
It's apostasy, is it not?
The technical, of course, it is apostasy and blasphemy, because if you speak against Islam or whatever you say is seen as denigrating or criticizing Muhammad, that's immediately apostasy. Blasphemy. And apostasy, of course, is it's similar hand in hand. If you're seen as straying away too much from the faith and saying things that go against it, you're apostatizing. So,
both of which are capital offenses.
They're capital offenses, and people do get killed for it. And so,
and even short of the capital offenses, one other feature of Sharia that is, I think, abhorrent to most of us are the very severe punishments for various perceived crimes, whether it's infidelity or whether it's petty theft, for that matter.
It's very draconian.
Just a word on that, because it is what characterizes, it seems, the most severe of these regimes. The Taliban in Afghanistan come prominently to mind, but they're not alone. And the juxtaposition to the kind of mores and traditions and values of the West is, you couldn't be further apart on the spectrum, it seems to me, of, you know, civilization. What do you think?
Well, it's, and again, we have to trace back to the origins of Sharia. It traces back to what Muhammad says, and Muhammad's living in the 7th century, so punishments were barbaric, from amputating a hand, whipping people, stoning people. So that's still part of Sharia. And see, this is one of the problems where...
because he was the perfect man. His model was to be, you know, replicated.
Right. He was the perfect man. And so what he says, we have to do literally. And that's why, so again, it's like caught in a time warp. Even the punishments have to be like that, uncivilized. But, you know, you say the word uncivilized, and it reminds me of something which is very important, I think, to bring up. And that's that here in the United States, and I can give you the name later, it's in Dearborn, a Muslim think tank actually did a poll about Islamophobia in America. And this Muslim think tank, it thrives on trying to show you that Americans are Islamophobic vis-a-vis Muslims. But what it found was the exact opposite. It asked primarily three questions, which is, are Muslims more prone to violence than other people? Are Muslims hostile to America, Western society in general? and are Muslims more uncivilized than other people? And lo and behold, the one segment demographic in American society that believe these three, as they call them, tropes, more than anyone else by far, were Muslims themselves. Okay, so I think that's very telling. I think when it came to the civilized question, because we brought up that word, it was Muslims were three times more likely than the next group. And they had other groups, Jews and Protestants, evangelicals, you know. But they were three times more likely than other groups to believe that all these things. So I think that's very telling. And these could be Muslims who were referring to true moderates, but who do know their co-religionists very well, and they know how they think. Or they themselves could believe all this, and to them, it's a boast to say, yes, we are more violent. That makes us more virile, you know, and I've read that, and I've seen that, and we are more uncivilized, because that makes us more, you know, down to earth, where you people are soft and weak, and so forth. So I find that very
This brings me to, and I don't know the particular group, but I would be surprised if they're not part of this, as I say, infrastructure of Islam in the United States that is dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood. And Raymond, talk a little bit about that organization worldwide, but here in the United States especially. As you mentioned earlier, it claims to be nonviolent and has been regarded, therefore, as moderate, notably, but certainly not exclusively, by the Obama and Biden administrations. But calibrate again. Where are they on this spectrum of full-on Sharia adherence versus authentic moderation of a civilized kind, if I could use that expression?
Right. So the Muslim Brotherhood, or Al-Ikhwan, you know, the Brotherhood as they're known, was born in Egypt. Hassan al-Banna is its founder, you know, and its whole premise was to, you know, reinvigorate Islam, because Islam was, you know, on the wane, and Egyptians and Muslims in general becoming overly westernized, because it was this.
Well, and Ataturk in Turkey had taken down Turk, the caliphate.
Yeah, he's the perfect example, right? Again. You know, the Ottoman, the final caliphate and sultanate, the Ottomans, who actually terrorized the West in the name of jihad more than any of their predecessors, went so far as to jettison everything about their Islamic identity, including the language. They used to use the Arabic script, and they adopted the European Roman alphabet till today. So there was that fear amongst these more hardcore Muslims and trying to reinvigorate Islam. So this is the origins of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you had people like Sayyid al-Qutb, also Egyptian, who was the great ideologue of the Brotherhood, who wrote, he was very prolific. And he's the grandfather of all these,
among other things, right?
Yeah, Milestones, exactly. And Milestones is basically exactly that. It's a step-by-step guide of how to bring back essentially the caliphate. So the long and short of it is that's basically what this group has been doing. But they are now, the difference between them and ISIS or Al-Qaeda and so forth, and Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, in as much as Ayman Zawahiri, who was, of course, recently killed and who was the leader of Al-Qaeda until he died recently, is Egyptian and was in the Muslim Brotherhood. But he didn't like that their method was one of patience and, you know, being methodical and playing the moderate Muslim game and trying to subvert and get into a civilization. So in the United States, when their offices were raided, and out of the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got all these different offshoots. One of the most famous, of course, is CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. And all of them are dedicated to the idea of just infiltrating the government, the society, and whether it's through their own machinations or propaganda or whatever, subverting the order in favor of Islam in whichever way that is. And so they're in the captured FBI documents. It actually said, and I'm somewhat paraphrasing, that our mission is a grand jihad, and that actually is verbatim, in sabotaging their miserable house. Western civilization, or America in particular.
By their hands, meaning ours.
By their hands.
As well as the hands of the believers.
By their hands.
I want to come back to this point, because it's really critical to understand what they mean when they talk about bridge building and interfaith dialogue, big project of the Muslim Brotherhood at the moment. We'll be right back with more with Raymond Ibrahim right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The son of the last Shah of Iran, Prince Reza Pahlavi, spoke powerfully yesterday to and for the Iranian people. His speech was widely broadcast and well-received. It can help bring down the tyrannical regime that's long misruled them and threatens us. The prince says he's not interested in running a successor government, but he outlined what it should look like, namely one that is democratic and therefore accountable, secular, instead of theocratic, and inclusive, truly representing his nation's many ethnic minorities, religions, and regions. Barack Obama says it was a mistake when he ignored such aspirations in 2009 in pursuit of a nuclear deal with the Ayatollahs. The Biden administration is signaling its efforts to do the same are at an end. We must now demonstrate our solidarity with those seeking freedom in Iran and actually help them achieve it. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Raymond Ibrahim is in the house virtually. We're talking with him about the object of his intense study and including in his important brand new book entitled Defenders of the West, The Christian Heroes Who Stood Against Islam. And we're talking about why they were obliged to stand against Islam throughout history, much of this 14th century of jihad. Raymond, the Muslim Brotherhood, as you mentioned earlier, is an organization that is, it claims to be the leadership of the Muslim American community. It has built, in addition to the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the any number of sort of offshoots of these various enterprises, and mosques and their schools and their community centers and the like, most of which are called Islamic societies of, you know, fill in the blank. But one of the things that they have really developed to an art form is what they call it's interfaith dialogue, a kind of bridge building. And I just wanted to ask you, I'm sure you know from Sayyid Qutb's book, Milestones, there's a famous expression by him as to how this bridge building is actually supposed to work to advance, you know, the triumph of Islam. Do you have it, you know, in a paraphrase at hand?
Well, possibly not, because there's different aspects. But one of the things that he talks about, and you may be alluding to this because it's definitely relevant, is there's this idea. There's two aspects to Muhammad's mission, and we Muslims must copy it. One is the Meccan, and this is the revelation of Meccan versus Medina. But when he was in Mecca, the earlier portion of his career, he was weak. Muhammad outnumbered, and he was at the mercy of the pagans, the Quraysh tribe. And this is when all of his actions were moderate. He preached coexistence. He preached peace and tolerance. You have your religion. I have my religion.
There's no coercion in religion.
That's where all that comes from, this early phase. Then when he went to Medina and became a warlord, essentially, and went caravan raiding at the Battle of Badr and so forth, that's when you got all the violent militant verses. And that's why the more recent verses that come towards the end of his career, before he dies, are seen as the final say-so of Islam. But if you find yourself in the circumstance,
the principle of abrogation, actually,
right,
is
exactly
very important.
Right. But if you find yourself in the situation where Muhammad was in Mecca, then you apply those verses. So if you were like Muhammad, are outnumbered, you're living in America, okay, you can't go on a jihad and conquer America right now. Then you employ that mentality and those verses. You have your faith, I have mine. There's no coercion in religion. So it's always
and that goes back to what you were saying earlier, that ISIS found fault with, that it's a patient, subversive.
ISIS and Al Qaeda and these groups, yeah. And
not, that's not why so much groups. Peaceable, is it, Raymond, as sort of pre-kinetic
phase,
right?
Exactly.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
And paraphrasing, I guess, Ketub, but the one I was thinking of is he had an expression to the effect that there is no bridge that can be built to span the chasm between Islam and the infidel, except for the purpose of bringing the infidel to Islam. Right. In other words, it's a one-way bridge, not this authentic interfaith dialogue basis. To the extent that that characterizes what the Muslim Brotherhood is up to in our country, I'm just very keen to get your thoughts on the fact that particularly the Biden administration, the Obama administration before it, but especially the Biden administration has made a point. I think the president as a candidate expressly committed that he was going to put Muslims into every rank of his government. There are several that come to mind that are now the U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Rashad Hussein, and a man who's just been appointed to the International Religious Freedom Commission by the name of Mohammed Majid, both of whom have fairly impressive pedigrees in brotherhood organizations and affiliations. This seems to be part and parcel of that strategy for penetration and subversion.
Absolutely. It's happening all throughout the West, including in the United States, as you note, with these three hires. And that's the game. That's the point. So the brotherhood worldview, as opposed to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the violent ones, is we still want the same thing that you want, the ISIS-ites, which is conquest, caliphate, Sharia enforced everywhere. But we do it differently. We do it by infiltrating, subverting, and we do it through the system itself, as I said.
At least until we're strong enough to have the other
option. Until we can actually at least be strong enough. Right. Yeah. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood motto is still the Quran and the sword, and following the Prophet. It says jihadist
and be ready.
And be yes.
Engage in jihad,
be prepared, which actually is a verse from the Quran as well. Because preparation is very important and building up towards it. So and unfortunately, this works hand in hand with sort of the Western mainstream culture of this wokeness and whatnot, but the idea of just trying to help the minority, trying to be multicultural, trying to be inclusive, makes Westerners even all the more prone to taking in these basically wolves in sheep's clothing. One of the most highest profile aspects of what we're discussing is when you see Pope Francis with the Sheikh of Al Azhar, Ahmed Al Tayyib, the Grand Mufti. And it's just amazing because
Al-Azhar being the main theological
being the near equivalent of the Vatican for the Islamic world. And it's just amazing, what goes this man Al-Azhar. Okay, this man of Al-Azhar will speak one language in Arabic, literally and figuratively, to fellow Muslims in Egypt and so forth, and he'll basically support the death, the killing of the apostate, support the suppression and possible killing of the blasphemer, go against the idea of building churches, being, in other words, he will be a staunch Shariaist, okay? Then when he meets with the Pope, he says the exact opposite.
Or they're willing to play along
and
for their
the
own Pope's
people
and
must know this.
We'll explore that on the other side.
I know this because it's right there. I can read it.
Raymond Ibrahim, the author of The Defenders of the West, right after this. Welcome back. We are completing with this segment our fascinating conversation with a man deeply knowledgeable about the nature of Islam, how it is practiced, not by all Muslims again, but by the ones who are considered to be the authorities of the faith, for sure, and those who regard themselves as the most faithful adherents to the teachings of Muhammad and Quranic guidance. And it's a picture of mostly violent warfare that these folks have brought the world for 14 centuries. But we're fascinatingly talking about a group that has adopted a somewhat more, well, shall we say, Takiya-esque approach to accomplishing the same ends, or at least getting to the point where they can do so with the sword violently when they're more powerful. And Raymond, I'd like to pivot from sort of the general sort of conversation that we've been having to some specific cases. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but there is a very powerful tradition in the House of Saud to support this traditional authoritative practice of the faith. And yet, particularly since the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has come to power effectively, if not in full title, he has backed away from the relationship that the Saudi royals had long had with the Muslim Brotherhood. And that role has now been largely taken up by the Turks and the Qataris, of course, who've been bankrolling them for years. To the extent that this is perhaps operating, and the Brotherhood doesn't much appreciate it, they've been rather, I think, clear that they'd like to see the Royal House of Saud overthrown, in fact. Is it possible that this is one of the reasons why a Biden administration that has been under the influence of the Brotherhood and penetrated by it, maybe now talking up the idea that they want to revisit the U.S. relationship with the Saudis in a more formal way? They've done a number of things that have, I think, been problematic from the Saudi point of view. In fact, pulling out air defenses, for example, and recognizing the Houthi rebels in Yemen that are attacking the Saudis and so on. But what's your thought about these power relationships within the Muslim world, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the Brotherhood?
Yeah. So first we have to, of course, underscore for whoever's not aware that Saudi Arabia is probably the one Muslim, the one nation in the world that has probably done more to spread radical Islamic idea than any other nation due to their enormous wealth. So, what we call Wahhabism, which is just another strain of radical Islam or Sharia supremacist Islam, they're the ones who have just been disseminating it and paying for it in mosques all throughout the world, including in the Western world. Here in Washington, D.C., we regularly find mosques that get exposed for teaching jihad and ISIS type thing. So that's them. And it's always been curious, the relationship between the United States and a group like that. But of course, realpolitik comes into play and explains all that. I think the one thing I would caution against is when we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood and their machinations and basically how they approach the preparation, the takiyah, and so forth, this is not something that they built themselves. This is something that is really integral to Islam. As I was mentioning, you had centuries of this happening over and over, so that it's almost instinctive amongst these various Muslim groups. They all do it. Going straight back to Muhammad, for example, there's a famous hadith. His friend, a close companion, Abu Darda, he says, "We smile to the face of people while our hearts curse them." Okay, so that strain of, that strategy, if you will, has really permeated the whole of Islamic history. And as far as the Turks, well, they're becoming even more and more open and, saber rattling in a way, especially under Erdogan, who just wants to recapture the glories of the Ottoman Empire. And it's, it's amazing. I always see how
rebuilding the caliphate.
Literally, yeah. And you can tell what a person's like by who they like. So here in the United States, where Western statues of Western heroes are being toppled, even though many of them were great men in the context of their times, he extols and always celebrates people like Mehmed II or Muhammad II, who conquered Constantinople. But if you look at the conquest of Constantinople, it did nothing to the Muslims. It was just an infidel. He gave them the three Sharia choices. And once in Constantinople, the atrocities are mind-boggling. The mass rape of nuns, gouging their eyes, burning churches, breaking. And this is recorded in their own histories. And yet they'll celebrate that. And it just shows you where they're going. But again, all of these groups engage in the sort of subterfuge when they're dealing, especially with what's seen as the most naive element in the world, Western peoples, unfortunately. Yes.
Who want to believe this is not true, who are highly susceptible as a raw result to the cognitive dissonance, shall we say, of the evidence. Right. Raymond, we only have a minute left, but I just want to ask you to round this out, if I could, by picking up on something you said a moment ago. And I know you're not confused about this point, but it is redolent of the confusion that is in much of the West. You mentioned, in addition to Sharia supremacist, radical Islam. And one of the things that I've taken away from the little study that I've done of it is that what we are describing here is not really radical Islam. We may think of it as radical, yes, but it is authoritative Islam. It is the very tradition of those who believe exactly what Muhammad taught and enjoined them to do. Have I got that right?
No, you got it right. And it's unfortunate, but those words are so embedded, you know, radical, that dichotomy, radical and moderate. But as you say, what we call radical are just true observant, you know, Muslims. And the more radical we see them, that's just a reflection of the more observant they are of their religion. And the moderates, that word is also not accurate because, you know, are you moderating God's truths? You either accept it or you don't. So moderates really, right, yeah. Moderates, you know, you can essentially call them apostates. Or just, or see them as, you know, so many Americans and Westerners, they're just secular, which means whatever their religion is, it's some backward, it's something in their mind, and that's it.
Somewhere operating.
Right.
Raymond Ibrahim, we could go on, and I hope we will in the near future. Thank you for this hour. It has flown by. We've learned an awful lot, and I appreciate so much your work, including this most recent work about the defenders of the West. I hope everyone will get it. And that you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Sorry, 3, 2, 1. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time here at Securing America. In the meantime, go forth and multiply.